So this is the second to last one, I think. Yeah. And if we're lucky, and if I don't talk too much, we might actually finish early today. So, you know. In any case. So why don't we start with our normal, you know, let's do some breathing meditation to calm the mind. Or if, you know, as we've discussed before, you know, you could use a visualization, for example. That works too. In any case, so let's start with the breathing meditation, and then, you know, then we might do an analytical meditation. Maybe on the, you know, last time I think we did impermanence and death, right? Well, just mostly impermanence. So maybe today we'll do the next one in Ram Rim is preciousness of this life. So do that one. Okay. So so first of all, let's start with our, you know, with a 9-round breathing. It's good to have, you know, kind of have the practice, you know. So let's just do the 9-round breathing. For those of you, anybody here who's this the first time? Okay. So 9-round breathing is you close off your left nostril, breathe through your right, and then close off your right nostril, out through your left. So you do that 3 times, in from the right, out through the left. And through the right. Out through the left. And then we reverse. We close off our right nostril and into the left and out through the right 3 times. And then normally through both nostrils. So then we set our motivation that that with our practice, may we understand the delusions and afflictions that we suffer from, and we can remove them, and but not only for ourselves, but once we want to benefit others as well by generating compassion for them because they have the same afflictions that we do. We can also rejoice, you know, rejoice in our actions, you know, if they were constructive, good, virtuous things we did today, we can rejoice in that. Rejoice in all our past virtuous actions and the ones to come. All the works that, you know, all the projects, etc., that Rinpoche has, you know, he's trying to benefit his students and others in all these different ways. You know, all the teachers who are teaching, like Geshe-la and Rinpoche, His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And all the great beings and the other faiths, you know, all the saints and sages, you know, so there's many, many beings who are continuously working for others' benefit. We just don't hear about them. So we rejoice in all their efforts. And then we can start our concentration meditation on the breath. The most important thing is, if you remember the 7-point posture, you can just go through those points and you can take the posture, or otherwise, the most important thing is just to have the back straight, but relaxed, the natural curvature. And just set your mind on the breath. Just notice it, just continually. And if your mind strays, just gently bring it back. So we take our life for granted. We never think about what other alternatives there might have been. And the scriptures say that this human life is extremely rare, extremely rare. Have the classic analogy where imagine a turtle at the bottom of an ocean, vast ocean. And on the bobbing on the waves of the ocean, the turtle comes up for air once every 100 years. So it sticks its nose up, you know, above the ocean every 100 years. And bobbing on the ocean is a yolk, like a round lifesaver kind of thing. So it's bobbing around everywhere to turtle comes up once every 100 years and sticks its nose through the hole in the yolk. As rare as that is, that's how rare our human life is. So most of our lives, since beginningless time, the vast majority of our lives have not been human lives. If you want to use a more rational or way to think about it, you know, think about how many beings, sentient beings, insects, animals, etc., are just in this county. This is Wake County, so in this county, probably trillions or quadrillions. I don't even, you know, I wouldn't know. But how many people are there? At most, 1 million, maybe 500,000. So that ratio, 500,000 to billion, trillion. So we could have been one of those. But instead, we have this body with which we can benefit others. We have a mind that's intelligent, that can discriminate, that knows, can understand right from wrong. Lots of people have minds too, but doesn't guarantee to be, because there's lots of people who suffer from mental health issues, whose faculties are not what they could be. So we're not one of them either. So we have our intact mental faculties. Our basic needs are taken care of. We don't have to worry about going out for food or hunting for the next thing. We have leisure, a couple of hours in the evening on a Monday night, to spend time on spiritual practice. The vast majority of people in this world don't have that opportunity or leisure. That we live in a country that allows us to practice without obstacles. That we have a spiritual community that supports us. That we live in a time where the Buddha has arrived. There are many eons, called dark eons, in which there is no Dharma, there is no Buddhas. They don't appear. Because the beings in those eons are not ready to receive the teachings. So we live in one of those fortunate times where a Buddha has appeared and turned the wheel of the Dharma. That there have been qualified masters who have held the lineage, who are all the way from 2,500 years ago to now, have brought the teachings, you know, without being diluted, without being, you know, they're the original teachings. You know, and then there's great masters who can interpret the teachings for us. Just reading the words, we may not understand. Geshe-la, for example, Rinpoche, when they give commentaries, they're interpreting the teachings for us so we can understand. So all of these, and also that there's a Kadampa center here at all. The South is not known for its prevalence of Buddhist centers. So all those conditions, had to come together. For us to make spiritual progress in this life. So that's why it's so precious. It's rare, of course, but not just rare, it's incredibly precious. The human life is the only form in which one can make spiritual progress. Not as an animal, not as a god, certainly not as a hell being or a hungry ghost. So that's why it's incredibly, Rinpoche says, so precious. Incredibly precious. So let's sit with that understanding for a bit. And if it fades, you just think about the logic again and bring it back. You know, bring how precious this life is. You just do that and then sit with it again. You just do that over and over. That's why, you know, when, if you go to, if you go to, you know, if you go to a teacher and you say, you know, my practice is kind of falling apart, or I'm not making the, you know, I'm not able to make the effort and so forth and so on, or I've become lazy, let's say. So they will say, go back and meditate on the preciousness and rarity of this life. So because that's how we gain the understanding how there's not a moment to lose. And of course, the next topic that comes after this is how short that life really is. And it gets shorter every moment that we live. So then it makes it even more clear how precious this life is, or at least this moment is. So, okay. I don't know why I have a camera thing sitting in front of me. Okay. Any questions like from the last class or the once before? You've been doing some meditations at home. How have they been going? I mean, have people been doing the meditations? I'm not going to ask people to raise their hands. You know, it was funny. The first, one of the first teachings on the Lam Rim that I ever went to, which was, must have been the early 2000s. And it was being taught by this Swiss monk called Venerable René Fussy. And there were, you know, and it was at this retreat center called Vajrapani, which is in the Santa Cruz Mountains in California. And it's in the middle of the Redwood Forest, and it's, you know, it's about 40 minutes, you know, on this windy, twisty, two-lane highway, and then about three or four miles of unpaved dirt road next to a creek. So that's finally how you get there, right? So we'd all make this effort. You know, there were people coming from San Francisco, which takes about an hour and 15 minutes. For me, it took me about 50 minutes, maybe 55 minutes on a good day. So we'd all make the effort to show up on a Tuesday night, I think it was, and we'd go to this class. And he was, the first class, he basically late, you know, he's a Swiss guy, you know, he's basically just, you know, it's got to be exactly. And so he basically said, okay, I expect you to do every single meditation I tell you to do. I expect you to do them every single day. I expect you to, you know, reserve an hour for this, for the meditation and for the study. And then every week he would ask, who did it? And of course, you know, you couldn't really lie. So it was a lot of fun, actually. It was a wonderful, wonderful class. Anyway, somebody had a question. Yes.
So that was kind of loud. How often would you? So I'm doing some analytical meditations. I've been doing the death awareness meditation, and mm-hmm. I'm just not really sure how many times per se I should do that. You know, it's like, you know, like I don't expect to 100% master it, but I don't want to spend, right, you know, do that forever and never meditate on anything, yeah, else. And
so we discussed this more in another module called Establishing a Daily Practice, right? But the way what they say is that you get the insight, you get the realization of one topic. Let's say, you know, the Lam Rim begins with the with the spiritual teacher, you know, how precious he is, and so, or her, she is, so forth and so on. Then it goes into death and impermanence, impermanence, then it goes into preciousness of this life, then it goes into the, you know, how we're pretty close to dying, death, and then karma and refuge and so forth and so on, right? Keeps going. So the classical way they say is, you know, back in the old days, you know, you do one, you gain the realization, then you go on to move on to the next one, right? So, you know, that's when people basically went into the case for a month and did it for a month, you know, and they gained the realization. So nowadays, what Rinpoche, for example, said, like a few years ago, I heard him, was, you know, you do them for a couple of weeks, right? You do the topic for a couple of weeks and get some sense, some insight, right? So you do the couple of weeks, you get some insight, and then you do the next topic, and so forth and so on. But just because you moved on to the next topic doesn't mean you can forget the old one. So you have to spend a little bit of time before the next meditation on the previous ones, right? That's why the review meditation, you know, I talked about the review meditation last time. So that's where the review meditation comes in. You kind of go through your head. You go through all the meditations you've done before, all the points, all the things you've understood, and you just walk through them in your head. So you're at least every day you remind yourself of what you had learned already, right? Or you know, gotten insight already. And I don't mean learn, because learn assume, you know, means study. This is not study, right? This is experiential. So every day you do 2 weeks, then you do 2 weeks, you do 2 weeks, like that, right? Until you get to the end, and then, you know, you start over again. So, you know, so I'm on my, I don't know, fifth, sixth way through the Lamrim, you know. And each way through the Lamrim takes me about maybe a year and a half, a couple of years, something like that, you know. So, you know, and every iteration cycle that I do, I pick a different book, right? Or, you know, different text, right? So that way it's a little, you get a different viewpoint and so forth and so on. So like that, you know? So that's what people usually do, like who are like us, you know, who are, who can't just go and just shut ourselves off for a month, you know, and, you know, do the meditations. But usually a Lamrim meditation, if you were doing it by doing retreat, would be about a month or so. You know, something like that. Maybe some would be a lot longer. You know, as you get towards the end, they get a lot, you know, they get harder. So they take longer. But, you know, the beginning ones at least take about a month or so, maybe. But, you know, for us, we just do it in the mornings. You know, it's just to, you know, one of the reasons they say to do the Lamrim meditations is to create the imprint in our minds. You know, that's probably the most important thing, right? Maybe we don't gain a lot of realizations, right? We do, you know, we make our way through the Lamrim, you know, maybe we haven't gained that much, you know, and so forth and so on, right? But the main reason they say to do this is to create the imprint in our minds, so that, you know, in our next life, we will continue, right? We create the conditions to meet teachers, to meet the Dharma, to be in, you know, that what I just went through, right? To be in a time where the Buddha has appeared, you know, where they're qualified teachers. I mean, there's a lot of conditions, right? Plus, of course, you have to have your human life. But a lot of conditions that have to come to fruition. And so it creates the, you know, those causes and conditions, you know, to continue in our next lives. So that's one big reason why to do the Lamrim. You know, why to, or not just, I mean, the Lamrim is just one way of studying the Buddha's teachings, right? So there are other ways, but in this tradition, we focus on the Lamrim. So to create the imprints, if nothing else. Anyone else about the meditations that maybe you've been doing?
In
Just a quick question. You had mentioned in an earlier class about the visualization that goes along with the nine-round breathing.
Yeah.
Do you mind repeating that?
You know, I probably regret having mentioned it because it's not, you know, this is not really sanctioned, I guess. But in any case, so because it comes from a, you know, a very advanced practice. You know, I don't do that practice, but I know of the practice and what's involved, and so I know the. But so it's, you know, so that's why I said it's not quite sanctioned. But in any case, so you have to kind of understand how let me see. If you've come to Geshe-la's Sunday morning, you know, lectures, services, whatever you want to call them. He mentions the winds and energies, right? Flowing, right? So, so we have the central channel, this, you know, channel that goes right through the center, like in between, you can imagine in between your shoulder, what are these things? Breastplates, yes, right? Like that. And then there's two sides, smaller channels, right? One on the right, one on the left. The side channels come up like this and then kind of go through the nostril, come down into the nostril, right? So they kind of go round like this. And then the central channel kind of goes all the way up to the crown of your head. You know, it kind of just goes right through the middle, you know, like a pillar up to the crown of your head. And then they all meet down at the lower chakra, which is halfway between your sexual organs and your navel, right? So there's the lower chakra. And so they meet basically by, again, hooking. I can't remember if it goes this way or that way, but in any case, they kind of hook down like this, come up, and then attach to the central channel. This is way too much detail. But in any case, so when you're doing the nine-round breathing, what's happening is you're breathing through your right, and there's all these energies, right, winds, they call it, but energies, that are always flowing, right? And the problem with us, they say that the reason we have, you know, we suffer from a lot of stress or anxiety or, you know, whatever, you know, pain or suffering we're going through, even bodily pain and suffering. The reason is that, you know, if the winds were flowing, you know, right through the, you know, up and down the central channel properly, then, you know, you would be in a place of bliss, right? Your body would be, you know, that's why in calm abiding, the ninth, you know, I was talking about this, right? Do you get this incredible joy and bliss and so forth and so on? So you have this, you know, this bliss. But for us, it's kind of knotted up and, you know, it doesn't quite flow very well and so forth and so on. So with the nine-round breathing is to kind of make it, you know, clear some of the channels, right? So, you know, when you breathe through your right, let's see, first one, yeah, breathe through your right. So it goes up, down through your right channel, hooks down, and comes up to the left and goes out the left nostril. So that's how that works, right? And, you know, same the opposite way, you know. And then finally, when you do both the nostrils, they go both down the side central channels, hook into the central channel, go up through, and then up to the crown of your head, kind of like that, you know. So that's the theory behind it, you know. And, you know, when you are, you know, and then at your heart chakra, of course, there is the, you know, there's the Buddha nature, the seed, right? The seed of enlightenment, if you, the you know, the seed of pure joy, you know, what we call the sorrowless state, right? Of the Buddhas, right? Of the enlightened beings. So you have that at the heart chakra, and so the idea of a lot of practices in Buddhism, right, is to clear these channels so that the heart, so that the heart chakra then can, the winds and energies can then flow into the heart chakra and so forth and so on. So anyway, so that's how it works. So that's what a lot of, like when you hear about highest yoga tantra practice and so forth and so on, that's what they're doing. But I'm not qualified to talk about it, so I can't. You have to ask a qualified teacher. It's true. I mean, that's why, Don, because Don teaches, I think he teaches the introduction of, isn't there a tantra, introduction to tantra or something like that at the end, right? And Don pretty much has been the only one who's taught that because nobody else wants to teach it because we don't want, and Don says, well, I'll probably go through like eons of hell realms, because, it's supposed to come from a qualified teacher. Anyway, yes, question.
Well, for me, it's, I was just reading the book, the How to Meditate, and even though I have been here in to the practice and we are doing the preparation for the meditation with the prayers.
Which prayers? I'm sorry?
The prayers.
Like, I didn't do prayers today.
Oh, No, I am saying I am... let's see, I have been more aware of the importance of the preparation for the meditation.
Okay, yeah.
So not just jump into the meditation.
Right.
But the preparation for the meditation, mm-hmm. with the intention and with the prayers, mm-hmm. I realize how important is that. And another thing is to... the awareness that somewhere, and I would like to hear your comment, that somewhere these enlightened beings, the Buddhas, are somewhere. No?
Mm-hmm.
And apparently we could connect with these mm-hmm. Buddhas, no, in order to help us to mm-hmm. to go forward. No. So this is my comment in terms of how I realize, no, even though I have been here and hearing the prayers and so on, so... suddenly say, it's how important is the preparation? Though?
Actually, you bring up a very good point, and this is something we talk about in the establishing a daily practice module more, but, it's doing all the preparatory practices is very, for us, we're not doing all of them. There's a, making water bowl offerings and things like that, which we talk about in establishing a daily practice, creates incredible merit, right? Which is what we need to make progress, right? Create the causes and conditions, right? That's the only way we make progress. So there's a lot of, I don't want to say elaborate, but there's a bunch of different prayers that one does, setting the intention, making water bowl offerings, taking refuge, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? So Rinpoche, for example, before he starts his meditation, he might take just like 3 or 4 hours just to do the, the preparatory practices. I'm not saying you do 3 or 4 hours of preparatory practices, but it's kind of like, it is kind of like painting, Most of the work is in prepping, right? Once you've gotten all the furniture out and you've taped all the windows and all this other stuff, right? Painting becomes easy, right? So it's kind of like that. You really have to set the intention. I mean, I'm not going through the whole, all the preparation part of it, right? But the most important part is to, make sure that our mind is calm, right, before we do the practice, right? To set the intention, right? The motivation, because that is what the intention is, what creates the merit, right? And rejoicing is that's not necessarily part of the preparation. Well, it is actually part of the normal preparation practices. But this year I started doing this one because, rejoicing is such an amazing way of receiving blessings, from all the enlightened beings, and it has a way of softening our hearts, because our Because a lot of times our hearts are, I don't know, kind of hard. You know, we've got all these shells around it, right? Just, you know, we really protect it. So a lot of these practices, you know, especially when you meditate on the, you know, on the preciousness of your teacher, you know, is designed to soften your heart. And that's how you can get in touch with your compassionate side and so forth and so on, right? It's from that soft part of your heart. So, you know, so rejoicing, you know, helps with that, and also, you know, creates, again, positive, you know, easy way to create positive, you know, merit, right? To lay the foundation for our future growth. So that's why, you know, we do the, you know, I started doing the rejoicing. Because Rinpoche actually, last few retreats, he's talked so much about rejoicing. So I thought, okay, you know, I should add that, you know, so that's why. By the way, you know, when I do all these things, I'm not doing, you know, these are all the things I tell you about, and I'm sure this is true for Don and Robbie, right? These are all things that our teachers tell us, right? So it's not like I'm, you know, somebody, some big deal, right? Who, you know, come with all this insight and I'm telling you these things. These are all instructions. So what I'm telling you is, you know, come from some teacher somewhere, right? Some qualified teacher somewhere. Anyway. So yes, the that you write, that's a good comment. And regarding about the Buddhas, right? Where are the Buddhas really? And can you really connect with them? And so forth and so on. So, it's hard to explain. So when we die, we don't really die, right? I mean, we keep going on, right? Our minds, our subtle mind continues, right, into the next life and on and on and on, right? The subtle mind is the mind that actually is at the heart chakra. That is the subtle mind. And as you remove obscurations and impurities, etc., you know, the subtle mind is able to arise, right? And that is what flowers as the enlightened mind, right? So when we, each of us, when we achieve enlightenment, that is kind of what's going to happen. So when the Buddhas, the enlightened beings, just because, so what happens with them is when you're enlightened, the subtle mind becomes, you know, you got to read this, but they're called four bodies of the Buddha. There's four bodies that they have, you know, Dharmakaya. So one of them is the form body, which is what we see them as, right? The form, they take form on this planet and we see them. Like, let's say His Holiness Dalai Lama. Let's say you consider him a Buddha. So that's the, you know, he's considered, Avalokiteshvara, you know, Chenrezig Buddha, compassion, right? The emanation of him. So he is at this present day, you know, in Dharamsala, right? Because the Buddhas can appear in many different places at the same time. So there could be other Chenrezigs around, but at least that's the one we know of. So that's his form body that he's taken. Now, body called the Dharmakaya, you know, which is the, it's the subtle mind, it's what the subtle mind becomes at the moment of enlightenment, right? So the Dharmakaya, it's like the mind that is everywhere. It's the same mind that we have, right? Except that we haven't been able to open it yet, right? So, you can imagine where is our mind, right? How far does it go, right? I mean, if you think that the mind is not just the brain and the body, right? That we are more than just this, right? Then is it up to here? Is it up to the edge of the walls? You know, how far does it go, right? It's everywhere and nowhere. Kind of, right? Like that. And so the Buddhas are like that, right? So they are all around us right now at this very moment. And in their Dharmakaya form, right? The reason we can't see them is because we haven't, you have to have removed obscurations and afflictions to be able to see them in their Dharmakaya state, right? So we can only see them in gross bodily forms. So that's why, you know, when the Buddhas appear to come and help us, they appear in some form, right? But if you have been, you know, if your practice is really strong and you've made progress, then you can connect with the Buddhas directly, right? There are some students of Rinpoche's, for example, who I won't mention who they are, you know, but they have communication, you know. So it's real. You may read that Lama Tsongkhapa, for example, you know, did many, many prostrations and so forth and so on before writing his Lamrim. His great contribution to Buddhism was after Buddhism left India and went to Tibet, you know, and for a few hundred years it had kind of gotten mixed up, but, you know, and there were lots of, you know, their understanding had degraded. And so Lama Tsongkhapa took, you know, all these texts and he synthesized them and he put them together in a form that is absolutely clear and consistent. It's internally absolutely consistent. There is no contradictions. And the way he was able to do that is because he was able to directly communicate with Manjushri, the Buddha of Wisdom. So he would ask Manjushri questions about these contradictions and he would get explanations. And he would then write them down. So that's how the Lamrim was written. Right? He actually went to the caves with four students, I think it was. But anyway, so he and the four students. So, yes, one, there's stories, for example, like Milarepa, the great saint, from the 12th century, something like that. He was, you know, you should read his biography, this incredible, incredible biography. You know, he was a terrible person when he started out. He, you know, killed a lot of people and, I mean, he had incredible regret and he met this amazing teacher who made him go through incredible amount of, penance, I guess. That's one way to put it, in a Catholic way to put it. So he was meditating in this cave and he meditated, you know, for 6 years, I think it was, on Manjushri. And Manjushri did not appear. And so he went out and was about to give up and he went out and he saw this bird that was, you know, he got inspiration, you know, I'll shorten the story. So he got inspiration from this bird, etc. So he said, okay, I'll try again. So he did another 6 years, still no Manjushri. So anyway, so he did this a few times, you know, so 18 years have gone by. And then finally he says, okay, I think it's time to come out now, you know. And so as he goes down the mountain, he's on this road and he sees this dog that's lying on the road and he's, you know, in terrible shape. It's injured and it's half dead and there's maggots and stuff, you know, eating its body and so forth and so on. So, you know, he has this incredible compassion, right? So he says, okay, I got to help this dog. So what can I do? So he thought, okay, I'll pick up the maggots with my fingers, right? But then the maggots would die, right? So then he said, okay, I'll pick up the maggots one by one with my tongue, because that's soft enough that they won't die. And as he did that, the dog transformed into Manjushri. You know, all those 18 years, he was basically peeling away his afflictions, and he had this one last one that he had to get through, right? Which was, you know, this compassion, you know, and so the Manjushri appeared to him, you know, and he said, this 18 years, where were you? And Manjushri says, well, I was actually in that spittoon that's on the end of the, you know, edge of the cave, and you've been spitting into it all these years, you know. Anyway, so that's the story. And then, why did I get into the story? Yes. So then, you can read the story in the Lamrim, by the way, you know, it's not some secret. But anyway, so he picks up Manjushri on his shoulders, right? And he starts, and he runs through the town, say, here's Manjushri, Manjushri. And all these people look at him like, what is this naked guy? Basically, well, he had a loincloth barely, because, you know, he had no clothes, no nothing, right? So what is this naked guy running through the streets with his hands up, talking about Manjushri? Well, see, those people did not have... They had not been able to, you know, gain, you know, remove their obscurations, gain realizations, to see Manjushri in that form, you know, because Milarepa had, you know, done that, right? So he can communicate directly, but all those people can't see Manjushri, right? They can see only this crazy guy going through the streets. And they say that there was an old woman who had been practicing for a long time, and she had gained some realizations. And she was able to see Manjushri's feet, you know. So like that, right? So that's why we don't, you know, that's, you know, an example of, they say, of how, you know, why we can't see the Buddhas. Another way that worked for me, I remember this when I read this. I don't know which text I read this in. So the Buddhas, when they, you know, become Buddhas, right, Bodhisattvas, of course, they, you know, they have dedicated their lives to benefiting others, right? I don't know, by the way, I don't know, we're not doing our class, really. But, they've dedicated their lives to benefiting others, right? I mean, to bring all others to enlightenment, every single being, all the trillions that are in Wake County and beyond, right? So they take, you know, they, you know, those bodhisattva vows. I mean, if you take certain, you know, like if you, you know, even like Dara initiation or something like that, you know, you have to take these bodhisattva vows. You take these vows that you are going to do, you know, do some of these things. So there's Buddhas then, their vow is that whenever someone needs help, they will appear, right? I mean, so that's why I kind of say, like, the Buddhas don't have a choice but to help you. It's kind of like, their minds are not like our minds where they think, oh, gee, should I help that person because, you know, last year, you know. That's not how, it's like spontaneous compassion arises, and there they are, right? You know, like that, right? So the way to think about it is, how do the Buddhas appear? Well, how do the Buddhas, you know, how do their vows arise as, you know, Buddhas, you know, let's say one of you here might be a Buddha, I don't know, you know, so one way it was explained was, you know, you go to an apothecary, I don't know, I guess they don't have apothecaries anymore, but you go to a compounding pharmacy, let's say. Right? And you ask for a certain, you know, drug, right? So he kind of pounds it, he gets all these herbs and he pounds, you know, does all this stuff and he makes this, you know, medicine, right? But the medicine, and even after his death, the medicine still has its potency, right? So the apothecary does not have to be around for the medicine to still be, you know, to work, right? So the Buddhas are kind of like, you know, their vows are like that. They took this vow. And even though they're not around, it's because of their vow that they appear and that they're always around us and that they're helping us. I don't know if that helped or not, but that's one way to explain it. Okay, anyway. All right, let's keep going now, otherwise we'll never. So last time we were talking about obstacles to meditation, right? Or to obstacles to practice in general, I guess. So a couple of very common things that will arise is one called excitement. And, you know, there's a few of them. Excitement is one of the main ones. The excitement here doesn't mean like, you know, excitement means like it's a mind that's distracted by, you know, like pleasant sensations, you know, things of attachment, right? Memories or whatever that you want to relive, you know, movies you saw, whatever, this wonderful date you had, you know, and you're thinking, well, how wonderful that person is, blah, blah, blah. You know, those are all excitement, exciting thoughts, right? Now, last time we talked about how to, you know, when thoughts arise in your meditation, what to do, and one of the things we said was, you know, they're like clouds in the sky, right? The sky is the mind, and the clouds appear, but they're gone. Our thoughts are like that as well. They're ethereal. Ethereal? Yeah, ethereal, right? Is that the right word?
That's right.
Yeah, okay. I was thinking ephemeral, but I guess that's not quite the same. But anyway, yeah, so they're ethereal. You know, they don't have any substance, right? So they're just kind of here and they're gone. And so you kind of just wait for it to just go, right? And we talked about a couple of ways to do this, right? The soft way and the hard way, you know, right? But some of these excitements, thoughts, you know, they don't, they're, you know, because we are such, you know, we live in the, what's called a desire realm, right? And the reason it's called a desire realm is because it's just so much attachment, right? So when there are thoughts that are coming out of attachment, they won't go away. It's very hard to make them go away, you know. I mean, if you had a wonderful day, there's no way that thought is going to go away, right? So so what to do, right? Or maybe, you know, you could have aversion too, like something really bad happened and you're just, you know, it's going over and over, you know, so you exaggerate the bad qualities of it. Attachment is when you exaggerate the good qualities of something you like, right? So, you know, so sometimes, you know, you can use a knowledge of impermanence, for example, how, you know, dates arise and they go, you know, just because you had one good date does not really mean anything whatsoever, right? You know, or whatever. You can think about, you know, so there's ways to, you know, think about how causes and conditions make these things arise, right? And so the karma has arisen for this thought or this date, whatever it is, to arise. And so there's no, you know, it's not because, you know, so it's not necessarily, it's going to also, the karma is going to deteriorate, right? So it's also going to be gone. So ways to kind of think about it to see how what we see as really solid, because, you know, that's the problem, right? We see, you know, the new partner or the new car or whatever is really solid, right? And we have this attachment built to it, right? The grasping actually built to it, into it. So you use all these techniques to kind of, you know, some of these, and all of these you're going to learn as you keep going, to basically attack that attachment itself, right? So you kind of, what you have to do is, you kind of have to then take, so what that means is, maybe you're doing a concentrated meditation and you have all these thoughts that are going, just going round and round in your head, and there's no way it's going to go away. So you take a break. You basically say, okay, this isn't going to work. So I'll basically now look at this excitement, these thoughts that are arising, and see and look at the how, what, you know, what are they like? Is that really what reality is? Is that how things, you know, is that how it really is going to be? You know, you know, what benefit are they, you know? So, you know, the nature of the ego that's grasping at it, you know, so you kind of investigate, you know, those types of thoughts themselves, right? You're no longer doing concentration meditation. You're actually kind of like doing an analytical meditation, you know? So then at some point, and you might have to do this over some number of days, it depends, you know, it depends on how, you know, really strongly it arises. So then over time, as you do these analysis, you know, the thoughts you were having won't arise anymore, right? There will be others probably, but, you know, but at least those, you know, those will be gone. So what I'm trying to say is, don't try to power through it, you know. You're not going to be able to white knuckle through these kinds of obstacles, right? The more you resist, the more they're going to get stronger. So you just have to kind of learn that, you know, these things happen. It's just a natural process. And, you know, just because you were doing concentration meditation does not mean that you have to keep doing a concentration meditation. You can come back to it in a week from now while you deal with these issues, right? So excitement is one big one, right? The other one that arises is, the reason these things arise is because when your mind is somewhat pacified, somewhat calm, then all the stuff that is below starts bubbling up, right? In your daily life, you may not think about these exciting thoughts, right? But all these things are still there. They're underneath, right? So now that it's a little calm and, you know, remove the uppermost layer, those things are now really visible, right? And that's why they come up, right? And this especially happens, like, if you go on retreat, you know, if you go week-long retreat, two-week retreat, whatever, something like that. I mean, stuff like this happens all the time. So anyway, so that's excitement. Another one that arises is regret or guilt. You know, past things that we've done, you know, and each of us has done quite a few things that we regret. So those things come up, right? And those, of course, are strong as well, you know. I mean, you know, you might have really harmed someone, right? Through some action, you know, that was, you know, whatever. So, by the way, there's a difference between regret and guilt. Okay? Regret is where you just are, I'm so very sorry that I did that. I mean, really, that was not the right thing to do. And I wish I had done, you know, I wish that I can do something to remedy it, so forth and so on, right? That's regret. Guilt is, oh my God, how could I have done such a thing? I must be a terrible person. You know, I always do these kinds of things. You know, that's, you know, people don't love me just because I do. You see where I'm going, right? There's the ego involved in there, right? So that's the difference between regret and guilt, right? So regret is considered a positive mental factor, right? Because it leads us to purify things that we have done in the past, right? It's something that is good. You know, we want to purify harm that we have done. Guilt is not it's a negative emotion because it goes further deep in the ego, you know, and it makes the attachment to the ego even stronger. So that's the difference, right? So you have to kind of recognize it when it arises, whether it's regret or guilt, right? If it's guilt, you know, you have to find a way to turn it into regret, right? Get the I out of it. and just look at it objectively, and maybe something like that, you know. You have to think about how to do that. But in any case, when those kind of thoughts arise, again, they won't go away, so you have to deal with them. So with regret, what you can do is you can do the purification practice, right, to purify the harm that we have caused, right? By the way, not just in this life, in all those lives that we have spent in the past, right? And I'll just mention this, and if you have, maybe it'll be of benefit if you have something that you're struggling with right now that maybe you regret. So there are the four opponent powers. They're called the four opponent powers. I remember them as the four R's, you know. So there's regret, right? The first thing to generate is regret for the action, the harm that you caused, right? Regret reliance, right? To rely, if you have taken refuge in the teachings of the Buddha, then you take refuge in the Buddha Dharma Sangha, and in the teachings. Otherwise, if you have if you practice another faith, then however that faith, you're relying on saints or whatever of that faith, or maybe if you have some set of ethics, that you follow, then taking reliance in that, like that, right? So regret, reliance, there's remedy, right? So remedy is kind of like, one obvious remedy is, try to go make amends with the person, right? But that's not always possible. The person may be dead. The person may not be in a state where he or she is very willing to actually, accept your apology. So what you can do is there's mantras, some of the Vajrasattva mantras that I don't know if, around the center sometimes they've done that. So there's various practices like that. You can make prayers, to the Buddhas to guide us, to help us, right? So whatever like that you're attracted to, I guess, that works for you. Right, and there are many ways to do the remedy, So that's remedy, and finally there's resolve, to make a resolution to not do it again, because most likely we can't keep that promise. We probably will do it again at some point, but if it's a type of action that we don't do very often, then you can say, okay, I resolved, so you basically resolve to not do it for a reasonable period of time, whatever that is for you. If you lie once a week and you lied today, then you can say, okay, I resolve not to lie for the next 2 weeks, whatever it is, right? Something like that. Because that basically will reduce how often you lie, right? If you do it really often, then you just say, okay, I won't do it for the next 5 minutes, 10 minutes, hour, day, week, whatever it is, right? So you resolve, you should make a resolution to not to do it again for a reasonable period of time. Something that you, a promise that you can keep. Right? Remember, first of all, it's no good if it's a promise you can't keep. Secondly, it's no good again because it just makes you feel bad. Right? So there's no, these practices are not to make you feel bad. It's just the opposite. Right? So that's why it's said to do it for a reasonable period of time. So those are the four opponent powers. So if these types of regret, thoughts appear, and they won't go away, then you could try that, if you have faith in the teachings, then there is a, I'm pointing that way. It used to be there. I said, you know, the little purification, Vajrasattva purification, do we still have those things? Do you know?
The small booklet, I think, the daily
purification. No. Yeah, the little booklet. The, okay, all right. Yeah, the, oh, yeah, there she has one right there. Okay. Yeah. And Rinpoche actually put one, so that's the, that's actually really, you know, it's tiny. You can do it in about 5 minutes at the most, right? Something like that. And Rinpoche has put it in that form, that little form, because you can carry it in your pocket. So the minute you do something, you can, you know, whip it out and then do your practice, right? So that, anyway. So you can, so that's the four opponent power. So you can use that to purify past harm that you might have caused. And of course, you know, that's the same practice that we students of Rinpoche, we do at, you know, at night before we go to bed for anything that we might have done today, right? You know, we do a Vajrasattva purification practice to purify, because, you know, as you learn in the, I don't know, third or fourth module from now, the karma module, karma grows. You know, the longer it's left unpurified, the stronger it gets. So that's why a small effort today, a virtuous effort today, can have an immense outcome, you know, a couple of lifetimes from now or whatever it is, right? And same, of course, for negative, you know, action. So that's why if you engage in some negative action, then it's good to kind of purify it as soon as you can, right? So that's why we do the Vajrasattva practice at night. We kind of go through the day, you think about all the things through our day, and if there's good things we did, we rejoice, you know, of course, right? If not, then we, you know, we do, you know, we think about what we did and how it wasn't quite what we wanted to do, and, you know, and we, you know, do all these 4 hours. And sometimes, or relatively often with me, because, I don't know, my faculty doesn't seem to be very good, I'm sitting there and I can't remember anything bad that I've done. You know? I'm like, okay, what did I do all day? Anyway, so, you know, I have a very analytical job, so, you know, it's, I don't talk to very many people, you know, and so forth and so on. So, I, you know, it's like, it's hard to, like, do something bad to a computer, you know. So, in any case, so I asked once, I asked Venerable Rene, one of my teachers, and I asked him once, I said, well, you know, what do you do with the Vajrasattva practice if you can't remember? Well, he said, well, you know, what you can do is you can generate regret for all those actions you created in your past lives. I mean, there's lots of them. Right, so you go, you know, you generate regret for all the things you've done. You know, pick one action, you know, and then just, you know, that action you've done many, many times. You know, they, because we've had lives from beginningless time, there is nothing we haven't done. I mean, it's a scary thought. I mean, think about it, right? We've massacred people, you know. We've done sexual misconduct. Well, you know, that's not that uncommon in these days. But you know, I mean, massacre, all kinds of things, right? Whatever we look down on people today, when we see them, right, we have done those things, right? So we're not really that different. But in any case, so we can generate regret for those types of acts. That's what he said. So that's what I do. You know, when I can't remember anything, and I'm not asleep yet, because a lot of times, you know, by the 10th cycle of the mantra, I'm kind of like drooping, you know. But, it, you know, so then I generate regret for all my previous. So anyway, so that's something you can do. Okay. Dullness and sleepiness, I think we talked about it some last time already, what to do, right? Various things, you know, the pay thing you can do and other things you can do, less weird. There's also things like you can do, like, for example, you can meditate on the great potential of our developing our mind, you know, what we have to look forward to generate excitement for our spiritual practice, right? To kind of think about how, you know, fortunate we are that we found the path that works for us. You know, there's so many people, believers and non-believers alike, who are still searching, you know, for a path, you know, for themselves. So if you found one, then how fortunate you are, and or how, you know, that we have qualified teachers who have the depth of experience to help us, right? So there's people who have fought, you know, who can guide us, who know the way. And once you've kind of been doing this for a while, you have some confidence in the teaching, so you kind of know, okay, you know, I'm making progress. You know, you can see progress in yourself, so you kind of think about, you know, those kinds of things, right? If you're having problems with sleepiness and dullness, you know, you kind of generate excitement, right? You remember, when you have excitement, you have to bring it down, you know, the thoughts of attachment, right? That excitement, right? When you have those thoughts, kind of thoughts, you have to bring them, you know, you bring yourself down, right? When you have sleepiness and dullness, you have to come up with exciting thoughts that are not ego-grasping, right? So then you have to bring yourself up, right? So that's kind of how that works, right? And I was reading about this, and the final thing they talked about, I haven't had, do I know? I guess it's not, I don't know how common this is, but depression. So if you have, if you suffer from it now, or you are, you know, have predilection, you know, or you have, you know, it can arise in you, then this is something that could arise, you know, in your meditation, right? So the antidote is, again, the preciousness of this life. That's what they say, to meditate on how precious this life is, that this life is not a waste. This life should not be, you know, wasted, right? What did I write down? Oh, yeah, bring to mind the last time you saw someone do a nice deed that you admired. And so you can think about how every little bit counts, right? Every little effort makes a difference, right? This is, of course, you know, for mild depression. You know, if you have severe depression, that's a totally different ball game, right? Then, and by the way, there's always been, questions about, how does meditation work? How do these practices work if you're on, let's say, medication, for depression or, you know, whatever mental health issue one may have, right? Does your meditation suffer because of it, right? Because your mind is not the unfiltered mind, if you will, right? It's got some chemicals in it, right? So, I heard Rinpoche say recently that is perfectly okay. If you need medication to be in a state where you can practice and where you can meditate, right? Then go for it, right? I mean, because otherwise, you know, if you don't take the medication just so that you can meditate, well, you know, it's probably going to be other effects, side effects, problems that you don't want, right? So you're going to cause more problems for yourself, right? So, you know, so like that. So, that's not something that is counter to, you know, Buddhist practice, right? Anyway, and that's pretty much all I had to say for today. I mean, I just wanted to finish up all the obstacles related stuff. Anybody have any last questions? Okay.
I'm wondering what we're going to do next week. Are we going to have a test? Are we going to meditate? Do we need to know lists of things?
Oh, boy. Am I supposed to give a test?
I think every teacher does it differently. Sometimes there's a practice day and we might be here longer.
Right.
I
don't think tests really work. So for those of you who are interested, who would like to, get the certificate, et cetera, then maybe you can write a very short essay, right? Just saying what did you take out of this module? Right? What is it that really got you out of this module that you would keep with you and that you might continue with? Right? So maybe just, a page at the most, So you can kind of, if you want, you can turn that in and, And I'm not going to grade them. I am going to read them. I'm not going to grade them because the exercise here is not about me giving you a grade, but rather you having, think about these things, right? Because when you write an essay, you're actually meditating. You have to think about all this, right? So that can be the test.
Yeah, so I'm new to this assistant thing. This is only my second class. But what Robbie said is you can turn it in on the last day, or if you need a little bit more time, you can turn it in,
Oh, yeah, you can turn it in whenever you like.
I'll collect them and give them to you and have you look at them.
Right,
and
I mean, I guess for Erin's, so that she doesn't have too much work. I mean, don't wait a month to do it, but, at least, maybe within a week or two, right? I mean,
By the beginning of the next module, if not next week, then by the beginning of the next module.
Yeah, there you go, like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
December 9th, is that a Monday? I mean, January 9th, if that's a Monday. It's not the first. The second Monday in January starts. It is presenting the path. So
it's kind of like the overview.
Chaka says, Lamrim, that's it.
Yeah, it's the overview, kind of like.
Do we have class next week?
Yeah.
Yeah, we still have one more class next week.
Yeah.
We'll all be here next week.
Any other questions?
I did have one question about the FPMT site. Do we still go and sign up, and is there a password?
For this particular class?
Yeah.
Yes. So on the handout that you have at the beginning, and I can give you one if you didn't get it, it tells you how to log into the FPMT site. The FPMT site has the PDF that we've been reading, but also a video with, a teacher from FPMT going over the stuff. So there's some extra stuff there that you might want to see. And there is a key, a code you need, and then it's on that handout, and I can give that to you. Or if anyone listening doesn't have it, if you're streaming, you can email, is it db.program or program.db? Try one of those at kadampa-center.org.
Put it on both of them. Then one of them will get there.
Program.db at kadampa-center.org. You can email that and ask me for the code, and I can give it to you.
Okay. They had some good review questions on there for other classes and kind of little quizzes that you can take on there too to test your knowledge on the class.
There you go. Yeah, you can do that for yourself, certainly. Yes, back there.
Karma. Does karma is always negative, or do we also create positive karma?
No. Amazing amounts of positive karma. To be born as a human being, it requires immense, immense karma. Mm-hmm. To have, to have wealth, to have basic needs taken care of, to live in this, you know, to be in this society, we have created amazing amounts of karma. And especially to have met the Dharma, they say, to met the, not just the Dharma, but the teachings of Lama Tsongkhapa, to have the qualified teachers like Geshe-la, Rinpoche, I don't know, boundless amounts of karma. So yeah, so that's the good news, right? So keep doing what you're doing. By the way, the best way to have a human life is to practice morality, ethics.
You said in past lives that basically we've done everything like the massacring and all that. Can the same be said for we've done all kinds of positive karma generators?
Sure.
Or is that harder to achieve, so the odds of that are less?
Yeah, you know, they do say that because we have so much attachment, right? All our actions are to some degree, they use the word contaminated, which means like contaminated by afflictions, you know. They're not absolutely pure because there's the ego always involved. So, yeah, maybe there's a possibility. I don't know the answer to your question. I mean, it's possible that, you know, they say, you know, only, that's one of the things, by the way, in the Buddhist scriptures, they say that one of the few things that you cannot, in Buddhism, you cannot reason through it, or you experientially you cannot get to it, is karma. Only when you are fully enlightened can you see the full breadth and depth of karma. So, yeah. Anyway, yeah. Someone else?
I want to know if you can like recommend me something to read about the preciousness of life.
Oh.
Because for me it's very difficult every time that I try to meditate about it. Maybe it's because of what I'm studying, that the human life is not that important.
So, what are you studying?
Well, I'm a philosopher, and rights for the animals.
Okay.
The arguments you give,
okay.
Says that they are important also, and the human life is not as precious as unimportant. So for me, it's very difficult to think about it.
Well, I mean, remember, when we say the preciousness of this life, it doesn't mean that the other lives are not precious, right? It's just that this life is extremely precious because this is the only form with which we can, have spiritual growth. Right, because if you're an animal, then you can't discriminate from right and wrong. You're instinctual. You know, you have less, opportunity to practice virtuous actions and so forth and so on. Right, so that's the only reason that this life is considered more, you know, like rarer and more precious.
Can you like recommend me something to read about it?
Well, I mean, you mean like meditations or just...
No, like a Buddhist point of view of human life.
His Holiness wrote, I can't remember the book now. Well, the other thing I would say is that what you could do is read a commentary on the Lam Rim text, that chapter, you know, the couple of chapters that are on that topic.
Okay.
Right? That's probably the best thing I can recommend off the top of my head. So you can read that section, right? I wouldn't read the original Lam Rim, so I would read a commentary, and you can pick one like Geshe Sopa has a wonderful one. He, you know, it's a modern commentary, right? So he just passed away that last year. So.
Okay, perfect.
Right. Oh, okay. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
So, and of course, these modules will cover it. Okay. Any last one? Oh, yes.
If you said Maybe he already asked.
Wait, you found one?
The perfect human rebirth.
Well, there you go.
Same question probably on the preciousness. Or if you say that human, this is a chance that you got to be born as a human, but there's so many bad humans. So what karma did they make to be here?
Well, I mean, they certainly created an incredible amount of positive, the Buddha's viewpoint is this, they created an incredible amount of positive karma to be born as a human, regardless of, you know, what they're like now, right? That's number one. Number two, you know, maybe their afflictions are a little bit worse than others, right? But it's hard to judge, you know, because, you know, they... What was your question? How is it that there are so many bad humans? That's what you said. Well, because, you know, some have, you know, maybe in this life, it just so happened their karma ripened in such a way that this is the life in which they have to purify those negative things from the past. And so their negativities, their suffering in this life is what is the outcome of that, right? So that's the best answer I can give you. You know, it's just how their karma ripened. That's it. You know, why is an animal born an animal? Same reason. You know, why is a hell being born as a hell being? Same reason. You know.
Not even a question, actually, just a comment on what you just asked. I like to try to visualize all the, you know, bad people as trying to teach me lessons. You know, all the things that they do out of ignorance are just that way I can see what I should be doing, and I just try to visualize all the bad things as being somehow bringing me up. I don't know.
Yeah.
That always helps me avoid getting, like, I have anger problems sometimes, and that way I don't get angry at people who are doing things that they shouldn't be doing and stuff like that, and I try not to judge people, and it doesn't always work, but it does help a little bit.
Oh, one more. Okay, last one.
I'm not going to let you sit in the back anymore.
So, if we create bad karma and something bad happened in this life, when the bad thing happened in this life, at that moment we are purifying that karma that we create in the past.
Yeah.
Yeah? So when the bad thing happened, it's like, finally, I got rid of it.
Right. If you are going through some pain or suffering, you know, whether emotional or psychological or physical, right? It's some karma that has arisen, born fruit, right? So once that suffering is over, that karma is done, right? That's why they say when you start purifying, if you actually, you know, things can sometimes get, you know, we talked about this, things can sometimes get worse, you know, like you have like more sicknesses and stuff. It's because those much, much, much worse karmas are now getting purified and arising as not so bad karma, with not so bad effects, you know? So that's what they say. That's the theory. Okay. So let's finish with our dedication. So page 36 in the gold Essential Buddhist Prayers prayer book. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel Bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow, and may that which has arisen not diminish but increase more and more. Thank you very much. Keep doing your meditations.